Oh, hey.
It's been a couple of days. There hasn't been a take for a couple of days.
Okay.
You know what that means?
It means it's time for a take.
It is. It's take three. It's questions. Shmestions.
Questions, shmestions.
Eric Christensen, I'm curious to know. Basically, ask us anything.
Yeah.
Eric Christensen, I'm curious to know what Mark thinks distinguishes Belfast, a film
which
which he was significantly more effusive in his praise for, from The Fabelmans.
I think it's a more interesting portrait of a particular time and place. I think that The Fabelmans. I think Fabelmans is fine, and I think it's a sort of, you know, The Fabelmans is about Spielberg's childhood and is telling stories about the creation of a filmmaker, which I think is kind of interesting, but I also understand is not for everyone. That's fine. I think Belfast is a, it touched me rather more. I was more moved by it. And it just, you know, it just tickled my fancy a little bit more. I did say at the time, you know, we are in a period in which the filmmakers are making those films. And this relates to something that you said when you were talking to, you know, Hugh Jackman as well, this came up. There is a certain thing happening at the moment, which is reflective films about formative years. But they are comparable. I think Belfast is a better film.
I think it's a better film because it's more consequential. Okay. And The Fabelmans is lovely, but inconsequential unless you're Steven Spielberg. Whereas Belfast is not just about Ken Branagh's childhood. It's about the start of the Troubles. And seeing that reenacted and put on the big screen looked beautiful.
Yeah.
And
also, I mean, I think it's significant that Belfast played the Belfast Film Festival and absolutely took the roof off the building. You know, people loved it. So that's the hardest place for it to play. I always remember Mark Jenkins saying that he could make a Cornish film set in Cornwall, absolutely Cornish to the roof, but the place where he's worried about how it's going to play is in Cornwall. He says, because that's the place that people know whether or not he's off the boil. And I think the same is true, but Belfast played very well in Belfast. I think that's to its infinite credit, even though it has, you know, fantasy and, you know, sweetness and saccharine and all that stuff.
Of course. And also the best use of one of the best pop songs of all time, Everlasting Love by The Love Affair, at that final dance scene, which is just terrific.
Although that does remind us of something, that there was a more musical element in some earlier version of Belfast, but the Belfast kind of changed shape. Also, can I say, and this sounds like a really obvious thing to say, I love Belfast as a city. I mean, I'm there every year because I do the thing at the QFT, which is this Cinemagic thing, and I introduce a film for all viewers, and I do a Q&A with Brian Henry Martin, who's one of my, you know, close colleagues and a very good friend. But our godchildren or godless children, or however you call it, one calls it, we are their godparents, but in a non-religious way.
What's the best name for that?
I don't know. That's why I say godless parents.
That kind of, I know, doesn't
work.
Feel right either, does
it? No, it doesn't. That sounds like
mentor. It's that kind of thing, isn't it?
That sounds, yes. I don't know what the phrase is, but Paul and Janice are our old, you know, some of our oldest friends, and their children we have known since forever, and have been, you know, delighted to be part of that family. And so as a result of it, we've been back and forth to Belfast at least once, and often more than that, every year. And although the city has changed enormously in the last 25, 30 years, it's always been a delight going there. But right now, having gone there and played many times with the Dodge Brothers, he's got a rocking, rocking live music scene. It's great.
And Kieran Hines.
And Kieran Hines, that's right, yes.
Gillian, in fact, that should be his billing in every film, shouldn't
it? And Kieran Hines,
with Gillian, 41 and a quarter. Dear the good doctors, second time emailer. My first, I regaled with my survival after a West Australian bushfire and my subsequent use of Gerard's Greenland as an aperitif. Anyway, medium-term listener and vanguardista. Shorts. Not Bermuda, cycle, denim or budgie smugglers. Not even...
That's a phrase I haven't heard for a long
time. Not even corduroy. Definitely not. See previous takes for details. Shorts as in film shorts.
Okay.
Dr. Kermode often refers to movies he deems to be essentially unsuccessful, thus, this amounts to a short, this is not worthy of a full feature.
Okay.
What makes a short, other than being short? How long is a short? Inversely, how long does a film have to be classed as a full feature? What are your top shorts? Where is the best place to watch shorts? YouTube? Down with the and up with the and still love the show, Steve. Anyway, so in order then, what makes a short, other than being long?
Well,
you know it when you see it.
Yeah, no, if I can, there is a, if I can invoke Mark Jenkin again. So Mark Jenkin made a film called Bronco's House, which is technically a short. It's less than an hour long. I was having this very discussion with somebody the other day. Funnily enough, there's a piece for The Observer at the moment, which is, you know, great. They sent it to me saying great short films. They didn't mean short films. They meant great films that happen to be short. So you're thinking of things like, you know, My Life as a Courgette or Petit Maman. These are short films, you know, 60, 61 minutes, 62 minutes. That's a feature. 58, 59, that's a short.
Okay, so the hour is the cutoff point.
Yes. Unofficially, that does appear to be the case. Okay. So Bronco's House is under an hour. It's a short. Over an hour is a feature. I'm particularly aware of this because there are various cuts of The Fear of God, the documentary that I made, the longest of which is an hour and 15, which is a feature, the shortest of which is, you know, 52 minutes, which is a program as opposed to a feature.
Program.
So, yeah,
okay.
You know, program being a television program, but a short. So I would say that what defines a short is the hour mark. If it's over that, it's a feature. If it's under that, it's a short. Although obviously that is a blunt tool. As far as where to see them is concerned.
Hang on, before we get there, sorry. What are your top shorts?
Well, there's an absolutely beautiful short called Vinyl Verte, Green Vinyl, which seek it out because it's kind of, if I tell you anything about it, it might spoil it, but it is an absolutely brilliant, strange, weird, kind of magical, enchanting short. There are things like the short film that Jennifer Kent made before she made Babadook, which is really brilliant. There are the series of shorts that Marcel the Shell was developed from, the original one, which is just called Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. Then there's Marcel the Shell 1, 2, and 3. And then, of course, there's the feature. There are the early shorts by Lynn Ramsey, which you can get on the DVD of Ratcatcher, and they are brilliant and really, really worth seeing. There are the short films that Ari Aster made before turning to features, and I think arguably some of the ideas in those shorts are better played out in the shorts than they are in the film. I mean, an awful lot of cases you get, I mean, the Terence Davis trilogy, you get sort of the work of somebody who we know from making feature films, but those ideas are explored first in short format. That is quite often the case, that a short is a thing that will then lead you on to sort of future work. But Vinyl Verte, I'll pass the details on to Simon Poole. We can put it on the social channels, because I think it'll be available on YouTube. Is a really brilliantly odd and unsettling short that is just great. When we did the Shetland Film Festival, the last Shetland Film Festival was happening this year. When we did the one in connection with the Cultural Olympiad, we took a series of short films around the country, and that was really brilliant because it was just like a series of like exhibitions of short films. I used to do a thing on Channel 4 years and years ago called Shooting Gallery, which is a program which was entirely presenting short films and interviewing short film makers. So, I mean, I love shorts. The question about where to see them is actually the big issue now. And it is certainly true that Vimeo and YouTube seem to be the preferred channels, although there are obviously festivals because it's lovely to be able to see short films projected properly. It used to be the case that we had supporting features, and then there was a little move in the 1980s to have supporting shorts in cinemas. That unfortunately doesn't seem to have caught on in most mainstream cinemas, but that would always be a really interesting way of coming across that stuff. Most usually now you will come across shorts either on streaming services or if anyone's still buying DVDs or things, as the extras. So, for example, as I said, Ratcatcher comes with a collection of Lynn Ramsey's early shorts. The Terence Davis stuff is presented by the BFI. There are a number of really interesting shorts on BFI Player.
Okay, so there's
that was
the answer.
A fairly thorough.
Yes, well, there was a load of questions, wasn't there? Gillian, thank you very much. Todd, Simon and Mark, long-term listener, Vanguard Easter and Warwick University alumni residing in Old Roots in my first year and Hurst Flats in my fourth year.
Okay.
I had 4 years. I only had three. Anyway, Todd, thank you very much. Roots, that's a rough old place to be.
Is it?
Yeah. Not as rough as Tossall Flats, but Hurst Flats, I think they're
which
okay.
Which was rough as nuts, right?
Yes. Well, it certainly was back in the day. I'm sure everything is lovely now. Simon's recent experiences of watching Avatar, The Way of Water, over three sittings, and Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, over 17 sittings, still not finished, got me wondering, do you think it's better to watch a film in one go regardless, within reason of its length? Does splitting it into two or three chunks ever lessen its impact or always lessen its impact? Or does it not make a jot of difference? Has The Good Doctor ever employed the Mayo method? Well, I have to say, my method was just because I was sick and I had everything on my laptop, so I was able to be slightly more flexible.
Yeah.
But is it, do you think it's ever a good idea to split a film into chunks?
Well, of course, the purist in me says no, but the pragmatist in me says, you know...
Take an interval. Certainly, if you're going to start making movies that are 3 hours long, you can give us an interval, can't you?
Or he could make shorter films.
make shorter films. Have an interval and go and watch John Wick.
I mean, look, there isn't any rule for this, obviously. I mean, I like to sit down and watch something from beginning to end. But if something is on streaming or DVD, as it is in my case, because the internet where I live is so terrible that, basically it would take me 8 hours to stream a 4 hour film because of the exciting buffering. So I have no problem with people taking breaks and taking, you know, certainly comfort rest breaks, as they call it in, the restroom where you can go and have a rest, which is always
powder your nose.
That's right. The greatest euphemism ever. But I do think that what you lose is momentum, but I also think that if a film is 4 hours long, you can understand why. Mm-hmm. I mean, you should read Final Cut, the book about the making of Heaven's Gate, in which, you know, there's a contractual obligation that he has to get the film in under 3 hours, and he sits down to show them the fine cut, and he says, you know, there's a couple of scenes that could be trimmed a little bit, and Richard Brookson finishes the thing. He said, so we sat down to watch Heaven's Gate, all 5.5 hours of it.
Oh my goodness me!
It's just like
And certainly if you're going to be making, as Martin Scorsese has done, making a very long film and it goes on Netflix, you know that people are going to watch it.
Yeah.
It's going to have a pause.
Precisely.
They're going to have a moment. You're going to make a cup of tea. You're going to come back the next day.
Yeah. And there is even an argument that, well, why not just make it as a series?
Yes. Related subject, James Beattie, Forest Row in East Sussex. Last week, you spent a moment or two discussing the old VHS videos collecting dust in Mark's attic.
Yeah.
And it prompted me to write in to keep this conversation about physical media alive.
Yes.
Us listeners and your good selves obviously all love film, but the actual act of how we watch them isn't something that's been much discussed. I love DVDs and their modern incarnation, the Blu-ray, and I happily collect them knowing that the collection will never be complete. Well, obviously, in as much as you're not going to have a copy of every movie ever on DVD. It all started a few years ago when, after becoming frustrated at never being able to find the films that I wanted to watch on Netflix, or even worse, going to watch a film that I knew was there, only to discover that it had been removed.
Yes.
One day, whilst browsing in a charity shop, I picked up a bunch of favourites for next to nothing. And before long, I was hooked. Within a year, the collection had surged to over 1,000, and I began scouring the internet for missing gems and new films, and now I look forward to the days that I know certain films are coming out to buy in the shops. The collection now stands at 2,500.
Wow.
There is a question here, I promise. My friends think I'm odd buying these objects when you can apparently stream them at home. Whenever we watch a film in our house, we always go online afterwards to see what Mark's had to say about them, and I always wonder, how does Mark keep and watch his film collection. In our house, we dispense with the hard plastic DVD cases and keep the discs in plastic wallets arranged by genre. But I always imagine that Mark has rows and rows of beautiful white bookcases, like Daniel Cleaver's in Bridget Jones, full of gleaming videos and DVDs, all perfectly arranged and curated by staff. And that he imagines them on a wonderful home cinema. He watches them on a wonderful home cinema with plush velvet seats and a cracking sound system. Is this imagination close to the truth? I hope so.
Okay, well, it's interesting because the good lady Professor Herindor's and I have recently, at the good lady Professor Herindor's insistence, done a massive prune of the DVD collection, okay? Because she just said, this is just out of hand. It's chaotic and we need to sort this out. We need to go in. We need to sort this out.
Yes.
And she said it in that voice. So we went through the whole DVD collection and took out things that we are keeping. And then there's a whole bunch of other stuff, which is things that we are not keeping that are going to charity shops, because partly we're at a point in our life in which it is probably quite a good idea to start clearing out.
Yes.
Because what's that motto? Nobody else wants your stuff.
It's always remember that. And, you know, you keep them, maybe they're soundproofing, maybe they look good, maybe you just want to have them. But ultimately, when you go, the people are looking after you, go, do we want this?
No.
And also on VHSs, no, even charity shops don't want them.
Okay. So what's happened is we now have a beautifully, and it is in, they are in white bookshelves, a beautifully organized DVD collection of a few hundred DVDs that are absolutely essentially that we can't possibly be without.
Right.
And they are alphabetical and they are beautifully lined up.
Have you kept the plastic cases? Do you take them out? And
No, I've kept the plastic cases. Okay. Those are things. I also have up in the loft, which is where the video collection is, I have a box of about probably 100 videotapes that just for personal reasons I'm keeping. Like that copy of Driller Killer is never going anywhere. That was an important
part. Do you have a video player?
No. So it is literally just an artifact. The original copy of, you know, the British version of The Exorcist, the Swedish version of The Exorcist that Duncan Cooper brought me back from Sweden when it was outlawed on, you know, all that stuff.
So it's a bit like a trinket from a foreign trip, which you think...
It is precisely that. And it is also a trinket from my life that I, you know, I remember the cases of those things. But as far as the rest of them is concerned... They're going, and they are going to have to be dealt with quite thoroughly. And that means they're going to...
It sounded like, I'm going to be dealing with you quite thoroughly.
A bit later on.
Right.
But of course, me being who I am, I can't just throw a video away. What I have to do is I have to break the tape and unspool the things because...
Why?
Because when I was younger, we were always taught you never throw away video because then the video can be sort of copied and read, and it's piracy. You know,
these are features. It's an anti-piracy thing.
So break the tape, turn the things. Now that's fine doing that once. I have to do it about 4,000 times, and Linda was just like, "Just get a sledgehammer."
Correct.
Just
okay. That works.
Well, yes, that might be it. But then I have to do it. I have to bag them up and go. So, but it has begun. The process has begun, and it has begun because, you know, as anyone of our age knows, you have to begin this process now because it's going to take decades.
Yeah. And there'll be people listening who've cleared out their parents' house or their mum's house or
precisely.
Their dad's
and
house.
This is
or
the thing that is.
Whatever. Yeah. And then you start to look at stuff in a completely different way.
You do.
You go, my goodness me.
My.
Who wants this? Nobody heavens. Nobody wants this at all. So good to know that early on. And finally. I'm just trying to see who this is. Oh, here we go. This is from Fiona Rattray in the Hudson Valley in New York. Dear Truman and Punxsutawney Phil, I'm in Hudson Valley. I am Fiona Rattray. I'm a long-term listener, first-time emailer, reluctant former bassoonist and childhood frequenter of the Scala Cinema in Withington. To my eternal shame, I am the one who whooped loudly at the Levi's ad just before a one-off screening of The Jungle Book in 1984. It's very, very specific.
It's very niche.
But Fiona, thank you. It feels as though that there's a whole mini-series there to be shot. Referring to your conversation about having soft spots for certain songs heard over and over on recurring work soundtracks, for example, Lionel Richie's Living on the Ceiling and The Best of Neil Sedaka. This was, I think, a reference to our first jobs or stuff that we remember
That's right.
listening to.
Yeah.
And Burton's.
And the thing that I was trying to remember was that's when the music takes me,
which didn't have a short title.
No, it didn't. It was completely wrong. Although that was a short title.
So on the subject of the best of Neil Sedaka, I too, says Fiona in the Hudson Valley, have a soft spot for songs such as Laughter in the Rain, When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman, and I've Never Been to Me, thanks to a short-lived initiative to lull Greater Manchester bus riders into a calm daily commute in the early 80s. The playlists introduced me to the dubious world of easy listening and paved the way for a genuine appreciation for the genius of Mr. Burt Bacharach, recently sadly departed.
Yes.
Sandwiched between my parents' love for rock and blues and the punk-leaning preferences of my backseat of the bus compadres, the songs were a welcome, albeit soporific, interlude during the daily schlep between West Didsbury and the Manchester High School of Art by Strangeways Prison.
Right.
Does Mark remember the soundtrack on Manchester buses? And if so, which tracks evoke fond memories of smoky top deck rides through the eternal Manchester drizzle?
Well, I don't.
Fiona enjoys her sentence construction, by the way.
A beautiful writer. I don't. I went to Manchester in 82, and I don't remember music upstairs on buses. And certainly before that, I was in Barnet, and I don't remember there being music on London buses. What I do remember is when Sony Walkmans were introduced, and that was the first time I was aware of being able to, you know, as Cliff Richard saying, I've got small speakers, I've got tall speakers, big bad wall speakers, I'm wired for sound.
Yes, what but a song. One of Cliff's greatest.
I remember being wired for sound for the first time, but I don't remember. What I do remember is we used to get the school coach. So I used to, basically my childhood went up the Northern Line. So it went from Finchley, East Finchley, North Finchley, Totteridge and Whetstone, and then High Barnet. We used to get the bus from High Barnet to school in Elstree. And on the bus, the school coach, they would have on the radio in the morning, and the coach came at 8 o'clock, and it was either Radio 1 or Capital. And then on the way back, it was either Radio 1 or Capital. And Capital at that point had a chart every day. And so that was when I remember hearing pop music on a coach, but I don't remember it on a bus. Do you?
In Worthing, they didn't really. I cycled to school in Worthing.
Oh, okay.
And but the buses in Worthing certainly would not have easy listening. But I like the idea of being introduced to the music of Burt Bacharach on a bus ride.
I know, it's great, isn't it?
It's a fantastic idea. Right, I mean, obviously, there's no point in doing it now because everyone's got their own music. Although, to be honest, that it might be quite a calming influence. They played easy listening hits on all buses.
There is a ferry that does a trip out on the Mersey, okay?
There's a song in there somewhere.
No, and on the ferry, they are constantly playing Ferry Cross the Mersey. If you work on that boat...
Drive you crazy.
Exactly. I figure a week max.
I was told...
Before you take an axe to the sound system.
I don't believe this can be true, but I was told that in the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam...
The Van Gogh.
They always play Vincent by Don McLean.
Starry, Starry Night.
When they open. And but I would have thought that can't be true. Because, again, that would drive you absolutely crazy.
It would.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's true or not.
But that's a lovely memory, though. The very specific thing. But also the Scala in Withington. I don't remember that the cinema that I used to go to in Withington in the 80s was Cinema City. And then it was the Arbon in Hume.
Oh, okay. Well, Well, anyway, it's a very particular question. Thank you, Fiona Rattray, for sending it in from Hudson Valley. But at the end of that, the answer is no. Mark has no memory of any of that kind of stuff being played through the Manchester drizzle.
It does remind me, however, of my friend Ian in Manchester saying one evening when we were all sitting around in our flat, you know, talking rubbish. And Ian suddenly went, have you noticed how loads of places in Manchester begin with. I said, what? He went, yeah. Loads of places in Manchester begin with. And we went, like what? And he went, well, Withington, Withenshaw, West Didsbury.
Good. That didn't last long then, did it? Anyway, Fiona signs off, tickety-tonk, down with the Nazis and fanatical book banners. Well, let's just throw that back at you, Fiona. You seem to be slightly closer to the problem. So maybe you could do something. But just get back in touch and tell us what you're doing about that.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
How are you putting the world to rights?
And if you have a question for us, we would love to tackle it in some way. Send it to correspondence@curbinandmayo.com. Fear not, because there'll be a new take with you on Friday.